From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with a man who knows his place in the universe, Timothy Ferris. His new book, Coming of Age in the Milky Way, explains how we reached our current understanding of the heavens. Then it's back to the future of Earth when I speak with science fiction writer and editor Bruce Sterling. He's compiled an anthology of cyberpunk, stories that combine sophisticated technology with the attitudes and intensity of punk music. Our rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of Mott the Hoople, a band he says defined the 70s. And guest book critic Stuart Klawans reviews Harvey Pekar's comic series, American Splendor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Timothy Ferris. He teaches science writing and astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. Public television viewers may remember him as the narrator of the award-winning special Creation of the Universe, which he also wrote. His articles and reviews have appeared in Esquire, The New York Times, and Rolling Stone, to name but a few. He has received the American Institute of Physics Prize, as well as a Guggenheim Fellowship. His best-selling book, Red Limit, received the American Association for the Advancement of Science Writing Award. He has a new book, and it's called Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Timothy Ferris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Well, we have a real task in front of us. We have to talk about the history of the universe in about 30 minutes, and you managed to keep the history of the universe down to under 500 pages. That's a task of rather Herculean proportion, isn't it?
Well, we know so little about it. That's I've tried to specialize in things that which we're almost entirely ignorant, and that way it's possible to become an expert in them.
So what do you mean? By doing little bits of the history of the universe, you kind of get an overview of the whole thing?
No, it's just that the totality of what we know about the history of the universe is so little compared to the reality, and always will be, that the best that we have been able to get, and ever will really get, is going to be just a glimpse through the keyhole. But it's quite exciting what you see even in that small glimpse.
It's our universe that we're talking about, though. It's not the universe as a whole, is it?
Well, the astronomers use a term they call the observable universe, which for technical reasons is more time-limited than space-limited. But there's plenty within it. The radius of the observable universe is something on the order of 10 or 20 billion light-years, and you've got somewhere around 100 billion galaxies with roughly 100 billion stars each in that area. So even if you consider that but a small portion of the total universe, which it may be, it's still plenty for everybody.
It took you 12 years to write this book. What was the hard part, sort of your mandate as a journalist, to get the facts straight and then try and communicate them?
that's pretty much it. I got interested in astronomy when I was just a little boy, and you know, when you have these childhood interests that you're lucky enough to be able to pursue as an adult, at some point you want to know about the history of the field, and so I undertook to write a book that would be a history of the concepts of the universe that we've had and our exploration of the world around us, and it was a wonderful process, but it turned out to be a lot more work than I would have thought.
Was part of the work finding the metaphor to kind of explain the mathematics?
Well, that's always part of it. You know, Robert Frost said that all metaphors are imperfect, and that's the beauty of them. And what you want to try to find is a metaphor that's imperfect in some defensible way, that's true to the spirit and the fact of what you're talking about, and yet blooms in some way in the reader's mind. And that is a lot of the part of it. And a lot of it is just, you know, pouring through thousands of books and the lives of hundreds of people and trying to figure out what the hell was going on.
You write, at about the time you're writing about the 18th century, that apparently journalism did have one contribution to science, and that's when the philosopher Immanuel Kant misread something, right?
there was a man in England named Thomas Wright who was a sort of a religious ecstatic, interested in cosmology, the science of the structure of the universe. And Wright used to come up with different theories about the universe and publish them every 6 or 8 weeks or so, and many of them mutually inconsistent, but all accruing to God's greater glory and so forth. And one of these books was reviewed in a Hamburg journal by a critic who got it wrong. And Immanuel Kant read the review and got the wrong impression of what Wright had said, but as it happened, the journalist's error turned out to be correct. What the journalist said was the first intimation of the actual structure of the Milky Way galaxy. And Kant immediately saw a connection between that and what the astronomers were seeing in the sky and produced the first theory of the existence of galaxies. Mm. If it hadn't been for that journalist, we might have had to wait another century.
That's a marriage that's been going on for quite a while, isn't it? That marriage of philosophy and astronomy.
Yes. Scientists today mostly don't like to talk much about philosophy. And philosophy, there's a good reason for that. Philosophy has lagged considerably behind physics and mathematics in the 20th century. But in the long run, you can't get away from it. Philosophy is like what Bob Dylan said about love. It doesn't matter what you think about it, you just can't live without it. You're going to have to go back to philosophical issues sooner or later. So I've tried to keep investigating those, even though it's not always popular with the scientists, and sometimes not even with the philosophers.
Well, even science itself, there were the scientists that observed and did experiments, and then there were other scientists that just... I guess sat around and thought about it.
Yes, the sit around and think about it ones are call themselves theorists, they're not so sedentary as their image suggests. Einstein, for instance, was widely regarded as the greatest theorist, perhaps of all time. Started out as quite an experimenter. In fact, he badly injured his hand when he was an undergraduate in an explosion in a lab while doing an experiment. He loved to tinker. And I find that, particularly among physicists, even the theorists usually have a skeleton in their closet in the form of a childhood attraction to tinkering and breaking things up and seeing how, trying to put them back together and so on. But in adult life, there is a sharp division between the experimenters who are in there in the guts of the particle accelerator actually pulling things apart and the theorists who work more in the abstract.
Mm. Einstein himself was really a fascinating character. That's one of the things I really like about your book is the way that you kind of illuminate these people's lives. And there's a story that you tell in the book that illustrates the tenacity of some of these scientists, Einstein in particular. It's the paperclip story. Could you relate that story to us?
Einstein was working at Princeton with an associate of his named Ernst Strauss. And they finished writing a paper together one afternoon, and they were looking for a paperclip to clip it together. And they looked through all the drawers and couldn't find any, and Einstein suggested that they look for something they could make a paperclip out of, and they kept looking, and finally Einstein found in a corner of a file cabinet a paperclip, and he unbent it into a straight piece of wire and then started bending it again to make a paperclip out of it, and Strauss looked at him and said, "What are you doing?" And Einstein realized what he was doing and said, "Well, I suppose this tells something about myself, that once I'm set upon a task, I can't be dissuaded from."
Fascinating story. Was there an era that particularly fascinated you as you were starting to write this book?
Well, the Greeks, of course, always haunt every history like this. You can't escape a fascination with the age of Plato and Aristotle. That lamp is just never going to be extinguished as long as there are people on this planet. And the 20th century, of course, in science overshadows all the others because so much has happened in the 20th century. So there tends to be these histories tend to open very strong and close very strong.
Mm. My guest is Timothy Farris. His book is Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Let's talk a little bit about ancient theories of the universe. There's a story that you heard when you were 9 years old about Hamlet's Mill.
Mm. There's an ancient Scandinavian myth that says that the Earth, as it turns on its axis, wobbles, and that the reason it does so is that there was once a great mill responsible for turning the Earth, and it was being transported by sea, and the ship sank, and the mill sank to the bottom of the sea. And because it was in the wrong place, it made the Earth wobble. And this is a fascinating story because the axis of the Earth does wobble. It's called the precession of the equinoxes, the result of it. And this was known to the ancient Greeks, but the knowledge was thought to have been lost in the Middle Ages, and yet here it seems to turn up in this old myth. In any case, when I was nine, I was in a rural school where I was going to school in Florida, and the kids were talking one day in the playground about why the sea is salty, and someone asked me why, and I started to give some sort of pontifical little answer.
When you were nine, right?
Yeah, I was insufferable even then, but, you know, the salts are going down to the sea and so forth. From the mountains. And a little girl said, no, that's wrong. The reason the sea is salty is that there was a great salt grinder on a ship, and the ship sank, and it kept grinding on ever since as the earth turned and it made the sea salty. And that's that same story.
Isn't that interesting? In your brief history of important events in the universe, which is about four pages at the back of your book.
Yeah. I was brief with a vengeance.
What do you say? Economy is a jealous god. Is that your?
Yes, that's true.
So you're bound to be criticized. But I was fascinated when I learned that when man first became upright and began to walk, the constellations had not yet formed. So the sky that the ancient man was seeing is not the sky that we're seeing today.
That's right. The skies, the stars are all moving across the sky at following their own paths. And what we see as the constellations is like a snapshot taken of, say, people in Grand Central Station at rush hour. At that moment, there's a given pattern. But as years go by, and it only takes a matter of thousands to tens of thousands of years for this to happen, the stars will continue to move so that the constellations as we know them will all be scrambled and people will have to invent their own, as they doubtless will if they're around.
As the ancient civilizations that coexisted were taking a look at the sky, say, for lack of better example, the Mayans, the Sumerians, the Chinese, were they all coming to similar conclusions?
There are some similarities, some of which may just be what the biologists call convergence, where you have a good idea and it's arrived at independently, or a bad idea sometimes. And others appear to have resulted from actual communication between people. You know, there does seem to have been quite a lot of inter-societal communication before the start of recorded history. A lot of ideas got handed around. So that the Big Dipper, for instance, although some people call it a plow, was a Big Dipper in China and in Europe many years ago. And that may be because it looks like a dipper, or it may be that at some point someone got together and they said, well, we think of it as the shaving instrument, you know. And he said, no, it really looks more like a dipper. And they said, oh, you're right.
So. Can you understand, because of man's relationship to the universe during the ancient days, man thought the universe was very close. The stars were, you know, you could almost, if you got to a high enough point, you could touch the stars, touch the sky. Where this belief in astrology has come from?
Well, in my view, the belief in astrology expresses a deep and, I think, mysterious longing to find connections between ourselves and the stars. And there really are a lot of such connections, even if the ones averred by astrology aren't among them. We're finding now much more intimate connections between ourselves and the wider universe than I think anyone a century ago would have anticipated. The Earth, after all, formed out of the same cloud of material as the Sun did and the other stars have. Our chemical composition is very much like that of the universe at large. The atoms in our bodies were once parts of stars. Particles from space passing through our bodies are affecting us in various ways as we sit here and talk. It really is all one great weave, and we're part of it, and we're just beginning to realize that the apartness that we felt from the wider universe was largely a myth.
The apartness that we felt was we are all part of it.
We really are. It's an old mystical assertion, but when you look at it scientifically, you really arrive at the same conclusion. You can point to gross effects, like the fact that the Earth may be due to be bombarded by comets in 10 million years, resulting in mass extinctions, including perhaps our own, if we're lucky enough to make it for another 10 million years. But there are also many subtle effects that are just beginning to be understood. There's no wall, in other words, between us and our planet, and there's no wall between our planet and the rest of the universe. It's all of one piece.
My guest is Timothy Ferris. His new book is called Coming of Age in the Milky Way, and I'd like to ask you about some of these little subtleties that we're discovering between ourselves and the universe after we take just a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Timothy Ferris. He teaches astronomy and writes extensively about science. His new book, Coming of Age in the Milky Way, charts the history of man's relationship to the universe, and that relationship is a lot more intimate than perhaps we thought before. What are those subtleties you were talking about? Can you give examples?
Well, one example are subatomic particles coming down through space. Millions of them are passing through us each second as we sit here and talk, and some of them strike cells in our bodies and create damage, and there are probably on the order of several tens of thousands of cells in your body and mine right now in which the little working agents are busy repairing damage caused by these collisions. Some of those collisions damage genetic material, and some of them, in those cases, create mutations. And some of those mutations are passed along to our offspring, and they affect the course of evolution. It's not the main mechanism, but it is one mechanism that contributes, therefore, to the variation of individuals and the species and to the course of human evolution. And I've often wondered, once we know this better and understand it better, a century or two down the line, if we may not be able to see literally in the faces of people or in the fleck of gold in an eye or in the pattern of a dorsal fin of a fish, some random element that has literally come down from the stars.
Mm. I'm speculating now, given what you've just said, about what theologists are going to think about this, because science and theology, again, is another marriage that's gone on through time, isn't it?
It really is. It's often said that there's a dispute between science and religion. I don't think that's true. I do think that there is a dispute between people who feel that they already know everything that they need to know and people who have a sense that there's something yet to be learned. And you can find pedantic, lead-headed, self-satisfied people in theology as in religion. I mean, as in science. And you can also find people who view life as an open-ended adventure in both those fields. And between those people, there's a real alliance. I don't think that it's fair to say, as some people do in the churches, that the scientists labor up one side of the mountain, and when they come to the top, they find the theologians already sitting there. I heard this remark made just the other day on a Christian television broadcast. I think that's wholly mistaken. A career in science is not spent arriving at the same, working hard just to arrive at the same conclusions that someone has already written down in a holy book. But the underlying desire to understand the wider reality and to invest life with an intellectual and moral worth greater than has been given to us already is shared by good people in both these fields and in art, for that matter, and many other fields as well.
Mm. And thinking about what you've just said, it brings to mind a man who you talk about in your book, Galileo, who I don't know, from reading this book, turns out to be not such a nice guy, you know?
He was not such a nice guy. No. He was a great man, but he was not a nice man. Mm. Einstein was both great and nice. Newton was great, but not nice. You know, you don't have to be nice to be a certified genius, and Galileo wasn't. He was quite a self-seeking, self-promoting guy. It wasn't entirely his fault. He had real financial problems, for instance, that he needed to overcome, and he did so by writing a best-selling book, and he had to cut some corners along the way.
Yeah, like claiming he invented the telescope,
yes,
right?
Yes, he did, that was not one of his grander moments.
Now, did he drop the cannonball and the bocce ball from the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
Almost certainly not. It's one of those wonderful pictures, one of those stories like Columbus was out to prove the world was round, you know, which is another myth. The problem with, you know, obviously, if you could take a cannonball and a little bocce ball up to the top of a tower and drop them and they both hit the ground at the same time, someone would have done that a long time ago, and and Galileo wouldn't have had to go to all the trouble of doing the experiments he did to determine that objects all do fall at the same velocity regardless of their weight. The problem is that air resistance interferes in that. That's why, you know, that's why a penny thrown off the top of the Empire State Building will not make a crater 3 feet deep in the sidewalk, as we were told when we were school children. Air resistance makes a big difference, so the experiment wouldn't work. Someone did drop two balls off the Leaning Tower, it appears, but it appears to have been a successor to Galileo who disagreed with him and was trying to show he was wrong.
Mm. Another person who was working at the same time was Johannes Kepler, who seemed to be the total antithesis of Galileo. I mean, this guy, everyone thought he looked like a slob, right? And he had no instruments at all, and yet he was a brilliant man.
He was a wonderful man. He was the greatest astronomer of his time. And he was one of Galileo's great supporters. When Galileo wrote his little book saying, "This is what I've seen through the telescope," a great question that was raised was, are we to believe this book? No one else has any telescopes. And even if you look through them and you see these things, how do you know that what you're seeing is real as opposed to being an illusion, such as you would see through a kaleidoscope? And Kepler put his reputation on the line by saying, "I believe that these observations are accurate and that Galileo's word is to be trusted and that this is a great moment in astronomy." Kepler then wrote to Galileo asking if he could borrow a telescope so that he could himself make these observations, and Galileo wouldn't send him one. He was too busy currying favor with the nobility. So it's, I'm afraid, you know, as people of moral character, Kepler comes off better than Galileo.
Hmm. Isaac Newton was born the day that Galileo died, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting. This Isaac Newton was a really strange fellow. He's studying optics. Now, did he really start sticking stuff in his eye, you know, to do these experiments? He did.
He took what they called a bodkin, you know, a little sort of something like a small belaying pin, and stuck it up behind the eyeball, between the bone and the eyeball, and used to probe around trying to figure out the anatomy of the eye. Lucky he didn't blind himself.
Really? Really? He's called the last of the magicians.
You know, Newton was so far beyond anyone else in the world that he was working in a landscape in which there were no boundary lines and no rules, and he simply went wherever his interest took him. He studied alchemy for many years, and probably poisoned himself in the process through mercury poisoning. He devoted tremendous effort to studying biblical scriptures and learning Aramaic and so forth in order to interpret the scriptures better. Hundreds of pages of Newton's papers are devoted to subjects that we today would find to be sterile and pointless as compared to his scientific work. But the thing is that he didn't know that. He had no way of knowing it. He was completely on the frontier in all of these fields, and he was all by himself. He created a whole world in his mind, and everywhere he went, it was unexplored territory. It was Lewis and Clark every day of his working life.
Amazing. My guest is Timothy Ferris. His book is called Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Isaac Newton deliberately left stuff out of his papers and you know, would be rather obscure in what he was writing. You interviewed a lot of scientists for your book. Did you find them to be forthcoming about what they were working on and what their conclusions might be?
You know, I always have. I've been writing about science now for, I guess, 15 years or so, and it has always amazed me the willingness of scientists to, by and large, to drop whatever they are doing and devote their efforts to trying to explain to you as clearly as they possibly can exactly what it is they're doing, and with the most passionate excitement in many cases. It's just the opposite of what you find, say, in a, you know, if you go to a NATO military installation in Europe, people tend to be a bit hedged, and they're trying to keep you from finding out what's going on because they're worried about security. If you go to a place like CERN, the big particle accelerator where hundreds of scientists work in Switzerland, it's just the opposite. It's like a white hole of information. You can walk down the hall, total stranger, and stick your head in and say, you know, I'm interested in this, and I understand you're doing something about it. And almost without exception, people will say, oh, well, here, let me show you. They're just... their whole community, you know, is geared to conveying information to each other because they have to do that to work. It's an open, unclassified, and open-ended intellectual adventure, and that's one reason that I think the scientific community is a good model for what other human communities could be like if we were just a bit more sensible about particularly international affairs.
In the ancient days, the movements of the stars and so forth informed their lives in a very tangible way. When a certain star appeared, you'd know that this plant was ready for picking and that sort of thing. With the, you know, the wealth of theories and discoveries that are going on every day, partially because of the technology that's available to us, computers can think very fast and, you know, the men are still... thinking. How much of these theories and discoveries are informing our lives every day?
Not very much yet, because it takes a while for them to sink in. Alfred North Whitehead used to say that it takes a great idea 1,000 years to be fully assimilated into human culture. I think that one of the most important realizations in the recent history of science is that the universe has had an origin in history, and that it's possible to investigate that origin back to very early times, to a fraction of a second after the beginning of time, through existing physics and near-future particle physics. But this is an enormous idea with tremendous implications that even those in the field can only begin to appreciate. And it's going to take a while before the average person who's not able to devote so much time to science can begin also to think about what these things do to his or her view of themselves and of the wider universe. But I can tell you that the potential is tremendous. It's a completely different way of looking at the world and at our place in it. And it will have an impact on ethics and as well as on the intellect. That, as I say, we're only beginning to be able to glimpse.
Very briefly, the very last words in your book are, "For all my pains, I only beg this favor, that whenever you see the sun, the heavens, or the stars, you will think of me." Do you hope when we go out at night now and look at the stars, we're going to think of you?
No, that was a man named Bernard de Fontenille, who was a wonderful science fiction writer. Mm-hmm. And I would urge anyone to, I don't need to urge anyone, but I certainly hope that anyone going out to look at the stars would think about the stars and about almost anything else before they thought about me. That would be a terrible effect for a book to have.
Timothy Ferris, thank you very, very much for enlightening us into our place in the universe.
Thanks, been a pleasure.
Timothy Ferris's new book is Coming of Age in the Milky Way. It's published by William Morrow. Ferris teaches astronomy and science writing at the University of California in Berkeley. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer and firefighter Dennis Smith. He is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Firehouse Magazine and has written many books about firefighters, including the best-selling Report from Engine Company 82. His new book, Firefighters, is about firefighters' lives in their own words. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Leanne Hansen with Fresh Air. Science fiction writer Bruce Sterling says we used to think of technology as big and distant, things like dams and rockets and skyscrapers. Now, technology's in our kitchens, our cars, and even on our wrists. Sterling says this change is reflected in a new type of science fiction called cyberpunk. Coming up, we speak with Bruce Sterling, who's compiled an anthology of the movement. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Mott the Hoople, the eternally odd British band from the early 70s, and guest book critic Stuart Kloans opens the comic book pages of American Spectator, Harvey Pekar's continuing saga of life in Cleveland, Ohio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. According to ABC News, a U.S. Defense Department report is blaming human error for the shooting down of an Iranian Airbus on July 3rd. According to ABC, the report says the Aegis computer system on board the USS Vincennes correctly indicated that the plane was climbing, not descending. But that information was either misinterpreted or conveyed inaccurately to Captain Will Rogers, who gave the order to shoot. 290 Iranians were killed. Neither the Pentagon nor the White House had any comment on the ABC report tonight. President Reagan has reluctantly decided to allow the plant closings bill to take effect without his signature. The measure was approved by overwhelming margins in both the House and the Senate, and the president bowed to political realities by not vetoing it. NPR's Brian Naylor has details.
The president has made no secret of his philosophical objections to the measure that requires companies to give their workers 60 days' notice before shutting down plants. He vetoed the trade bill because of the plant closing measure attached to it and gave every impression he would do the same after Congress approved a separate plant closing bill. But advised by Republican lawmakers that the issue would come back to his desk again and again, as one put it, the president today acquiesced. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater used a football metaphor to explain the president's reasoning.
Sometimes you've got to take a touchback in order to get better field position, and this is about what's the matter to.
The Senate Democratic leadership had been holding the trade bill hostage to the plant closing measure. Democratic leader Robert Byrd said today, after the president's decision was announced, that the trade legislation will soon be ready for a floor vote. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The White House revealed today a 10-point plan for fighting AIDS. It's the president's first response to the final report from his AIDS commission. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The plan contains a few specific new actions. The president asks the Food and Drug Administration to notify people who got blood transfusions before there was a blood test for AIDS, to warn them that they could be infected. And the administration declares that all federal agencies must immediately adopt a policy to protect those infected with AIDS from discrimination. But most of the 10 points are more general, calling for further study or more planning. And many people, including AIDS Commission member Christine Gebby, are saying the president didn't do enough.
My biggest criticism is the failure to just announce that he was going to put his muscle behind getting a federal anti-discrimination law.
A law to protect not just federal workers, but all those infected with AIDS. Gebby and others say the president's unwillingness to adopt more of the 600 commission recommendations is a sign that strong action against AIDS will probably have to wait for the next administration. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
The Senate today approved changes to the 1968 Fair Housing Act, extending federal protection to the handicapped and families with children. The measure passed on a vote of 94-3. The bill now goes to a conference committee to work out differences with the House version. Sales of new homes surged 8.4% in June, the biggest increase since February. The Commerce Department says sales of new single-family homes climbed to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 734,000 units in June. But economist Ken Goldstein of the Conference Board says new home sales have hit their limit.
Housing sales, even with this very good number, are basically back to the number of sales of about a year ago. And given the latest hike in the prime interest rate, after a period of time, there'll be some increases in mortgage rates. And this is going to represent, I think, a high watermark for the housing market.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose less than a point to close at 2131.22. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of one of the most idiosyncratic British bands of the late 60s and early 70s, Mott the Hoople. They originally formed as a backup group for the reggae singer Jimmy Cliff, and then, with a little help from their friends, went on to become a hit on both sides of the Atlantic. Mott the Hoople took their name from a 1967 novel by Willard Manis about an alien who visits Earth and finds the planet both bizarre and amusing.
I'll never forget the first time I heard them. It was in San Francisco, and I just started working at Rolling Stone. A friend was driving me somewhere, and this thing came onto the radio. It sort of sounded like Bob Dylan, but not really. It sort of sounded British, too. It sounded like this.
What do they care about the clothes that I wear? What do they get from making fun?
Bob Dylan singing a Sonny Bono song, Laugh at Me, which was about a guy ostracized for having long hair? No way, Jose. We drove around the block five times waiting for it to end and hoping the DJ would have the kindness to tell us what it was. And what it was Mott the Hoople. To me, Mott the Hoople defines the 70s. Part of that is because I became pretty good friends with their demented lead singer and chief songwriter, Ian Hunter, for a while. But another part is because if the 60s swept away all of the rules, if the psychedelic era made the dance floor safe to sit on, if it was, in the end, down to boys with weird hair and guitars, lyrics that made some sort of sense but not much, and a sort of loud crunching noise, then for a lot of us, better Mott the Hoople than, say, Uriah Heep. Lord, Mott was weird. They recorded songs with titles like Death May Be Your Santa Claus and The Wheel of the Quivering Meat Conception, both on the same album. Besides Ian, who played piano and sometimes guitar, there was Mick Ralph's guitar hero, Verdon Allen, called Fally for a reason you have to know Welsh to understand on that Dylanish organ, Overend Watts on bass, and a guy who wanted to be known only as Buffin on drums. They made four wildly inconsistent albums with their wildman producer Guy Stevens between 1969 and 1972, and except for the first one, which had Laugh at Me and a remarkable version of Doug Somm's At the Crossroads, I'm scared to listen to them these days. They toured the States, they hardly drew flies, and in 1972, Ian stomped around London saying that he'd had it. He was breaking the band up. Oh no, not if David Bowie had anything to say about it, he wasn't. Bowie got on the phone with Hunter and told him to get the band ready to record. He'd written them a hit and he was going to produce it for them. And he did.
But they rapped all night about his suicide. I'd kick it in the head when he was 25. Speed jive, don't want to stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars from his face. Funky little boat race. Television man is crazy. Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you get I'm a dude now. Hey, dude!
All the young dudes made them famous, even if it wasn't a hit. It was one of those songs that seemed to be about everything at once. Angst, bisexuality, rock and roll community. And the triumph of coming back from the ashes gave the band new confidence. Ian and Mick wrote a brace of great new songs, and in 1973 they recorded them on what may be the best British album of its era, simply called Mott.
Forgot my six-string razor, hit the sky. Halfway to Memphis, for I'll be realized. Well, I rang the information. Yeah.
What Mott was about was rock and roll and being a rock and roll star, but told from a very unself-pitying viewpoint that only a middle-level star like Ian Hunter could make credible.
I changed my name in search of fame to find the Midas touch. Oh, I wish I'd never wanted then what I want now, twice as much. We crossed the mighty oceans and we had a few divides, but we never crossed emotion, for we felt too much inside.
Hunter cared. That was his curse. He couldn't take the money and run, and because he'd lied about his age, he was closing in on 40, it was too late to be cynical about it. He loved what he was doing. It was that simple. And at about the same time as Mott came out, he published a book, a diary of the band's tours. But Fowley was gone. Mick was the next to go, forming a tedious supergroup called Bad Company. He cut a couple of tracks for the band's last solo album, The Hoople, including Roll Away the Stone, which was tight enough to have been a hit single, but wasn't. In his intensely pessimistic song, I Wish I Was Your Mother, Ian wrote, "Is there a happy ending? I don't think so." But he did manage a solo career for a while, and the last I heard, he was happily married with a kid in suburban New York. Mott the Hoople couldn't have lasted. It was too outrageous an idea. But for a while there, they shone pretty darn brightly in rock and roll's dark ages.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. In 1984, William Gibson's novel Neuromancer was published, and it ushered in a new genre of science fiction writing that has since been labeled cyberpunk. The vision of a not-so-distant future Earth advanced by Gibson and others was a tough, hard-edged response to technology that included many elements of pop culture. My guest is writer and editor Bruce Sterling. He's compiled an anthology of cyberpunk writing called Mirror Shades, and he's also written several novels and short stories. The age-old debate in science fiction as to whether or not technology is good or bad may have been answered by the cyberpunk writers. For Bruce Sterling, anyway, it's no longer a question.
Technology now is an intimate thing. Technology now is an invasive thing. Technology today is the soft contact lens and cable television. It's things that burst into your living room, that get right under your skin. I mean, we're not talking about the Hoover Dam anymore, some sort of large, big project that's off by itself. We're not talking about technology as being something on a pedestal. Technology is something that affects every aspect of the modern experience.
And that's part of the theme that comes through in what could be called this quote-unquote cyberpunk movement of writing.
I think so. Yeah. I think that's probably the most profound insight that it offers. The invasive power of technology. This is, you know, it's more than a theme or a fad here. I mean, we're talking about, this is the truth about our situation.
Moving slightly away from the ideological content of the work, could we talk about some of the props of this particular brand of writing? First of all, in the first book I read was William Gibson's Neuromancer, and
yes.
And your own book, the new book, Islands in the Net. There's a preponderance of things Japanese. There's Japanese words and Japanese food and Japanese music.
Yes.
What is it? What is it about Japan that sort of fits into all of this?
Well, these people have our number. I just came back from Tokyo. I was over there for 5 days doing a gig, you know, and we're actually, cyberpunks are far better known in Japan than we are in the U.S. But, you know, you go to Tokyo and you just see, I mean, that is where the action is. And, you know, the 21st century is not going to be a white Anglo-Saxon situation. I mean, people talk about the use of Japanese signifiers in the work of the cyberpunks as if this were some sort of, you know, fashion accessory. But these people are for real. They're intelligent, they're dedicated, and they're really smart, and they're very, very rich. If you want to look at things to see for real, then you've got to look at the Pacific Rim, see what's happening. Not only the Japanese, but the little dragons, you know, the newly industrializing countries, you know, the Knicks. But these people have our number now. They understand the nature of technology better, I think, than the Americans do. Mm-hmm. Which is why, you know, you can see that everything that Japan makes is faster, smarter, and cheaper.
One thing that's always fascinated me about this this genre, science fiction, is the ability to speculate on the reasons why things happened now, contemporary time. You do that in your own book, Islands of the Net. You talk about The Sicilian mafia and the banks being responsible for poisoning John Paul I,
yes,
for example. Is that part of the fun of actually writing like this, to be able to speculate on contemporary political and social and economic themes?
Sure it is. That's a great head trip. It's a nice mind game to play. I have a tagline that goes along with that. You know, in order to understand the past, you have to understand the future.
Elaborate just a little bit.
Well, I think that, you know, in the case of the future giving you an insight into the past, this is something that William Gibson and I are very concerned with right now, because at the moment we're working on a book which is set, it's a historical novel set in Victorian England. And I think enough time has passed now and enough sort of insight is mounted that we of the late 20th century are finally able to get a real insight into what the 19th century was up to.
This cyberpunk has been called a movement for a number of years now, and it seems like the movement itself is actually being co-opted by the medium. In other words, the ideas that are in some of the stories and some of the books have now appeared in movies or on television. Max Headroom, for example.
Yes, uh-huh.
Blade Runner. Does the writing cease then to have a cutting edge if the writing becomes, overrun by imitators and co-opted by movies, by television, by contemporary culture in general?
Well, there are different levels of co-optation. I mean, there's something thriving now that we refer to as sci-fiberpunk, which is essentially the standard sort of American science fiction male action adventure novels that use a few of the identifying tags and images and buzzwords, props, as you put it, of cyberpunk. You know, and of course the original Max Headroom, which was invented by two people in Britain, Cucumber Graphics, Annabelle Jankel and Rocky Morton. In the hands of Jankel and Morton, Max Headroom was a rather threatening figure. In the hands of the Coca-Cola Corporation, Max Headroom is just an object to, move capital with. Yes, that can happen. It's true that the movement in 1988 is no longer the sort of table-pounding, attention-grabbing entity that it was in, say, 83. Shirley writes for Hollywood now. Gibson writes mostly for Hollywood.
This is John Shirley, William
John
Gibson.
John Shirley, yes. Right. William Gibson writes for Hollywood. Lewis Shiner is doing mainstream novels. And Rudy Rucker is involved in some seriously rad and heavy computer simulations action out in Silicon Valley. So, I mean, the point of the movement was to seize some attention for writers who, you know, were just breaking into the field. And now that it's 5 years on, the role that we have is to, make use of the attention and actually prove what we can do.
Is that what you're doing in your own book now that's just been published in Islands in the Net?
Very definitely, yes. I mean, this is a book which really carries the war to the enemy, essentially. The thing about cyberpunk is that, fun as it was, the realms of cyberdom and the realm of punk are both actually quite insulated little territories. They're sort of subcultural ghettos, whereas this book really does reach out to a mass audience and tries to, you know, really grab people by the scruff of the neck and force them to confront these issues.
It does so in a way, though, that is very easy to read, whereas, I mean, you go back to, I'm going back to Neuromancer, there was this sort of wall of sound, prose style, where it was just absolutely relentless, and it didn't stop. And your book, Islands in the Net, reads like a mystery novel, you know? It reads like a detective sort of, of novel. It's a little easier to take. At long stretches of time.
Well, it has what Gibson calls plot traction, which is one of the advantages of genre writing. You can use, you know, literary techniques that are no longer considered fashionable in sort of high literature. But you know, it's very true. I mean, it is meant to be an accessible book. I've discovered that, you know, if you really want to get to people, you have to get to people where they live, right? I mean, in some sense, the sort of notion of, you know, having, say, you know, an orange mohawk, you know, and the safety pin business merely discredits anything you have to say. I mean, people immediately wall you off. So what you have to do is sort of come in under the radar, right? And plant ideas in people's minds that they're not equipped to instinctively reject. So that's what Islands in the Net does.
Bruce Sterling, thanks a lot for taking some time to talk to us today.
My great pleasure.
Bruce Sterling is editor of Mirror Shades, a cyberpunk anthology. His new novel, Islands in the Net, is published by Arbor House. This is Fresh Air. It's time to go down to Washington to find out what's coming up on All Things Considered. With me is Nina Totenberg, who's co-hosting the show. Hi, Nina.
Hello, Leanne.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, President Reagan has decided that the second time around, he's not going to veto the plant closings bill, and we'll have a story on that. Then the president also has a response to the recommendations of his AIDS commission. We'll have a story on prosecutors feeling that they're losing the fight against drugs, and then we'll have a story about Vice President George Bush campaigning on the road today.
Is he doing well?
We'll see.
Thank you very much, Nina Totenberg. That's all coming up on All Things Considered. Open most comic books and you enter a fantasy world. Open American Splendor Comics by Harvey Pekar and you enter reality. Pekar is both author and hero of the brutally honest American Splendor and has attracted enough of a following to appear on Late Night with David Letterman. Guest critic Stuart Kloans wonders, will success spoil Harvey Pekar?
George Eliot, may she rest in peace, made the famous observation that a heroine who wants to succeed had better be in the right place at the right time. I think the same thing goes for comic book heroes. What would Superman be outside of Metropolis? How could Donald Duck function anywhere except in his beloved Duckburg? And where would Harvey Pekar be without Cleveland? Where, for that matter, would Cleveland be without Pekar? Until Harvey Pekar started putting out American Splendor comics in 1976, the city was not exactly an ornament to culture. Jazz fans knew it as the home of Tad Dameron. Otherwise, Cleveland figured in the national imagination mostly as a place with a burning river and a woeful baseball team. And then came Harvey Pekar, determined to prove that his native city is a folkloric treasure trove, an enchanted landscape where every cafeteria and parking lot promises magic, where every office drudge and street corner philosopher speaks in pure, unaffected poetry. I'm not kidding, folks. The 13th issue of American Splendor has just come out, and it's gripping. You can read about how the cat peed on Harvey's Charlie Parker records. You can visit with Harvey while he and a friend wait for help at a cheap clothing store, and nobody gives them service. You can listen as Harvey remonstrates with a musician friend who's heavily into the bebop revival. The friend, by the way, is apparently checked into a state mental hospital, but that does not stop Harvey from criticizing the guy. Harvey is forthright. And he's public-spirited, too. There's an excellent 2-page spread all about how Harvey takes a piece of rubber out of the middle of a road, actually saving motorists from having to swerve around it. American Splendor has a more intellectual side, too. There are a couple of stories where Harvey talks politics. In another, he summarizes a whole novel by I.J. Singer, Isaac Bashevis's brother, complete with critical notes. I know that Picar is proud of these flights, but the stories I like best are the ones that seem most ordinary, like the piece where the most important thing that happens is that Harvey's interlocutor forgets what he was about to say. Which leads me to my one criticism of the new American Splendor. It used to be that Harvey did only the things that anybody else would do. That was the charm. Well, charm is not really what this is about. That was the stubborn working-class integrity of American Splendor. But now Harvey has become something of a success. He writes stories about being on the David Letterman show. Granted, the stories are about how he turns his interview into a debacle, but still, there he is in New York, appearing on TV, instead of standing in a supermarket line in Cleveland behind an old Jewish lady. I don't want to make too big a deal of this. I just prefer the traditional tone of American Splendor, which used to have stories titled Waking to the Terror of the New Day. Doubleday and Company has put out 2 big anthologies of American Splendor, so you can use them to bone up on the older material. The new issue is available wherever finer comic books are sold, or you can get it by mail. For information, write to Harvey Picar, P-E-K-A-R, at P.O. Box 18471, Cleveland Heights, Ohio, 44118.
Stuart Kloan's review, Small Press Fiction and Poetry for The Nation magazine. Here's what's on tomorrow's show. On the next Fresh Air, actor Lou Diamond Phillips. He's one of the best known of a growing number of Hispanic actors. He played rock star Richie Valens in the film La Bamba and co-starred with Edward James Olmos in Stand and Deliver. Now, he wields knives in the new Western, Young Guns. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of music by Kurt Weill. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.